This Week in Retronauts, Sega. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, and I am at Midwest Gaming Classic.
Yes.
And here in the high-tech studio with me is, returning from last year,
Anthony Schwader. How's it going, my man?
It's going pretty well, and Bob Mackey may be along. He had to go seek some curds. He likes cheese, apparently.
Yes, and in Wisconsin here, we like to celebrate cheese by deep frying it and, putting it in a curd form
It's cold up here, so you wanna pack on those pounds for the winter. I totally understand.
Right. And actually, the secret to a good cheese curd, not many people know this, but a good fresh cheese curd will squeak when you bite into it.
I see. So is that where the whole mouse thing comes along?
Oh, I never
mice
thought about
squeak,
that.
Cheese squeaks. Clearly they belong together.
Yeah, I think all these mice are just really seeking cheese curds.
I see. And speaking of mice, that's going to be relevant to today's podcast topic. This was an accidental connection, but I'm proud of it. So I asked Anthony what he would want to talk about for this year's podcast session. And he said, strangely enough, Kemco Seika.
Yes.
And so that's what we're going to talk about. And actually, that's a pretty cool topic because, well, for a few different reasons. One, because it's one of those companies that I think anyone who grew up playing NES or Game Boy games, like, ended up playing some Kemco games.
Absolutely.
And on top of that, their probably best known game or most beloved or most infamous game actually just got a remake on Xbox One, PS4, and Switch.
That's right.
So it's suddenly relevant, and we can talk a little bit about that, too. But first, I have to ask you, Anthony, why did you want to talk about Kemco?
Okay, so when we were first talking about this, I gave you kind of a list of what I thought were underrated companies that made NES games. And now that I've done a little bit of research, Jeremy, I'm kind of regretting putting Kemco on here.
Because you don't want to talk about them or because you don't think they made good games?
Well, when I got down to it, I think that they're kind of a below average developer themselves, but they made very smart and savvy publishing moves.
Well, that's important too. Publishing and developing were two different facets of the games business. Still are. But I feel like there was a lot more bleed over in the early days where companies, you know, would develop their own games internally, but then they would also publish other people's games. And you see that still with some Japanese companies like Atlus. They do that a lot.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But you don't really see it so much on the U.S. side. I don't know. I guess, yeah, like if you look at Square Enix, like what do they bring in from other companies? They'll reach out to other like contract developers to work on their products, but you don't really see Square Enix just like picking up properties to publish in the U.S. They're not like, oh, you know, this teenage girl school visual novel is going to be a huge hit. We should pick it up and publish it in the U.S.
The industry as a whole kind of streamlined into everyone kind of taking care of their own business. Unless there are some companies that do pick up like indie games, but I mean with the advent of Steam and the eShop, you know, the online transactions, it's so much easier for these indie companies to release their own games nowadays. So,
right. And so if you look back at Kemco, I mean, they really did have this kind of two-pronged approach where they were publishing their own games. They were making their own games, developing and publishing their own games. But they were also picking up external properties and bringing them to platforms. And for the most part, what they were doing, especially in the beginning, was finding Western properties and bringing them over to Japan for the consoles. And that was a pretty viable business model. A lot of companies did that, and it was a pretty effective way to expand, you know, their roster of games. And it was also very valuable because there were a lot of sort of Western computer games that just weren't going to be picked up in Japan.
Right, they were mining the West, kind of, and that was smart because these Japanese players had not seen any of these games, and sometimes concepts like Ultima or whatnot had not been seen by a lot of Japanese players, and it was kind of revolutionary in some genres anyway.
Right. And I think you saw more of this happening on the Japanese side than on the Western side. And that's because I think, you know, just the difference in the size of the markets. Like, there weren't necessarily a ton of companies in the U.S. who are like, we need to open a Japanese branch, because it is a small market. As you know, it's like the total population of Japan is like a third of that of the U.S.
Right.
So it's just not as compelling. Whereas, you know, for the Japanese, they're like, wow, the American market is three times the size of our market. So obviously we want to open up a branch over there. So you had companies like Taito and Nintendo and Sega and so forth, just starting up their own businesses, you know, their own, you know, Western branches. Whereas you didn't really have American companies doing that very often. Yeah, so it fell to companies like Kemco and Imagineering and so forth to take these Western properties and bring them over to Japan. And, you know, some companies that did that early on, like Hudson, had big successes with stuff like Lode Runner. Mm-hmm. And so this is where we kind of get to Kemco. We look at, you know, a year after Lode Runner came to Famicom and it was a massive hit. You have a bunch of companies saying, oh, yeah, hell yes, we want in on that business. Mm-hmm. And so that's where Kemco enters the picture.
So let's talk about Kemco just a little bit, like the origins. It started out as the Kotobuki Engineering and Manufacture Company.
As so many Japanese game publishers did. They started in another line of business.
Exactly.
And they saw there was money to be made in game publishing and game development, and they jumped on in. And there were dozens and dozens of companies that did this, and most of them ended up publishing just some crap and went away after like two games. But some of them stuck around, like Squaresoft, which started out as an electrical company.
And thank God.
Yeah.
Squaresoft has done
they found some great success. I think Enix also started as like another, you know, some other company. We were just talking about Heianko Alien. Meldak was a jazz music label in Japan.
No kidding. Okay. Yeah. All right.
So you definitely had some of this happening. But Kemco, yes, they started out not making video games, but they did eventually make their way into making video games, and that's kind of become what they did. And they're still around, you know?
I know.
Kemco is still around, and every other week or so, you log on to the Nintendo Switch eShop, and you see some sort of very generic-looking RPG with extremely generic-looking art and a very generic name, and you're like, this is a Kemco game, and it is. I don't know why, but their thing now is like... Seriously, like every other week, they just publish the most generic ass RPG on Switch. They have dozens of these things now, I think. And they all look exactly the same. They all look like, you know, someone's RPG Maker 14 version of Lunar or something.
Oh, man.
And that's what they do. I think these were all mobile games that they developed over the past decade. And then we're just like, well, we can just dump that crap on Switch.
There you go.
So it's kind of a, I don't know, It's a very specific niche they fill, but kind of like on brand for them, kind of consistent level of, yeah, whatever.
Now, I don't know if these are actually developed in-house by Kemco or not, these new games that you're talking about. But if they're not, it might be a case of, hey, it worked in the past. It put food on the table. Why not? Let's do it. Why not?
I mean, it could be a case where Kemco is like one dude who just like picks up and publishes the rights to these super generic ass RPGs.
It could be. Absolutely. Just a prodigy.
I mean, honestly, looking at these games, like they could just be procedurally generated. Like they just have a randomizer.
Oh, come on.
They're like, just, okay, I'm being mean.
He's
sorry.
Putting the hammer down, folks.
All right. But I've never played one of these games, but I just look at them. I'm like, these all look exactly the same. Like, seriously, this happened 2 days ago with the most recent eShop update. I don't remember what the game was called, but I do remember logging on. I was like just looking through, like scrolling through the thumbnails of new releases, and I was like, that one's a Kemco RPG. And I clicked
through, pointed it out.
And it was a Kemco RPG.
Nuts.
But that's not where they started. So let's talk about where they started. I kind of got off on a side.
Well, okay, this is a game that I haven't played, but I know that they kind of had their start with a port of Doughboy from the Commodore 64. Have you played that, Jeremy?
I am only familiar with it through Crontendo.
Oh, yeah, Crontendo.
But it was, it was a like a, yeah, it was kind of like sort of a proto-action, proto-strategy game. It's hard to describe. It's like top-down World War, I guess, one.
Oh, Doughboy, like, as in, yeah. Okay, I get it now. The military.
Yeah, stuff. It's not like, like, you know, Pickle Boy or something. It's
I was thinking like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
No. It's Doughboy as in a British soldier.
Ah, yes.
So it's like a, it's sort of a, like, kind of commando-ish.
Okay.
But there's more of an element of, I'm reluctant to say strategy, but it is a little, like, less direct action, just pure shooting than Commando. So yeah, anyway, I guess it was a pretty successful game on C64, but Dr. Sparkle did not have nice things to say about the Kimco port.
And you know, if Dr. Sparkle doesn't like something, then it's Kasuga.
That doesn't necessarily mean that much. He has very specific opinions, and I don't always agree with them.
Speaking of Kasuga, it's Kusoge. Kusoge. There's definitely a couple of games in here that I would label as straight up Kusoge.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Which, by the way, means shit.
Yeah.
Just pure shit.
Well, shit game.
Shit game. Game, yes.
As in game. Game. Yeah.
Game. Yes.
So, yeah, that is exactly correct. And this, I think, might qualify. You know, this was, I think, your notes here say that these games were internally developed. So I think this was a case of, as you saw with a lot of early Famicom third parties, them just like handing off the reins to, like, well, here's someone who's never really made a game before, but maybe, you know, programmed a spreadsheet for his mom or something. So we'll give them this game. And there was a definite learning curve. And by like 1987 or so, you really started to see kind of clear leaders emerge from the pack.
Right.
As people became more familiar with the hardware. But 1995, 1986, man, it was the Wild East on Famicom. It was
people just dipping their toe right into it.
It was, man, it was just like, you know, one of the reasons the Famicom disk system came out was because there was no quality control on cartridges, and people were talking like the system was 3 years old, and, you know, critics were like, well, this market's crashed. And it was going exactly the way of the 2600, but eventually there was kind of a winnowing. And I think it also helped that they did put quality controls in place for the US, like concept approval and things like that. So, you know, that was a huge market. So that, I think that kept the market from completely imploding and made Famicom development continue to be viable. But yeah, Kemco was definitely part of that gold rush, and you did not see a lot of gold come out of the rush. It was mostly the stuff that was just left over in the pan.
Now, when we're talking about Kemco in the early days, especially on the NES, there were a couple of mainstays at the company that actually worked on both games that they would contract in from other developers and also the internal projects. Hiroyuki Misuno was a part of every single game as the music composition. He did sound design for a lot of games, including the epic sound design for games like Deja Vu, Shadowgate, Uninvited, which did not originally have sound when it was part of the Mac Venture series.
Yeah, they were Mac games, so that was just like simple speaker beeps.
Right, and his work, I cannot say, like, when I thought very well initially about doing Kemco's Sika games here, I was thinking, like, how I loved, you know, Deja Vu and Uninvited and mm-hmm. Shadowgate, and I think the music has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, Kemco didn't actually make those games. They just converted them right. from Macintosh.
But the overlay of glaze that they put onto it and the actual system, the mechanics, the how you control the game with the point and click, that's all Kemco Seika.
That's true. Seika. Yeah, so we should actually talk about the name a little bit. So obviously, Kemco started out as Kotobuki Engineering and Manufacture. That's the KEM and Kemco. Seika, I think that was just their U.S. branch's name, and they included that name because the company was based in Seika, Japan.
Yes.
And so it's kind of a weird choice. Why not just call them Kemco? Maybe there was like another company already called Kemco in America.
I'm not sure.
But they were like, well, this is Kemco, and they're from a place in Japan you've never heard of. Okay, sure. But yeah, Kemco Seika, they are the same thing.
Yeah, with the dash right in the middle. Mm-hmm. And it's a memorable name. I remember it from my youth. It's like I would always it would always just pop into my mind, like, wow, I like saying it. It does. It is fun to say.
And it also it fits the cadence of the Muppet Babies theme, so you can sing it that way.
Kimco Seika, yeah, you make hot dreams come true.
Well, I don't know about that, but they definitely made some video games.
So on the other side, we have Kiminari Sueda, who is a graphic designer, and he, along with Hiro, they were kind of locking it down throughout the entire NES mainstay of all the games that they brought in. And so those two, in my eyes, were kind of the backbone of Kemco Seika as through the NES years anyways, and somewhat into the SNES years as well. So, yeah. I have a couple of notes on Hiro, since I'm in love with a lot of the music that he does. Mm-hmm. As I said, he's best known for like composing the NES soundtracks for Deja Vu, Shadowgate, Uninvited. And he left the company in March 1998 and started working for Compile as an executive producer. He kind of pinballed around after that.
Yeah, I was going to say the Compile was not long for the world after that.
Right, so right, yeah.
Maybe not the best career choice.
He actually started his own company, the ICA Corporation, where he programmed and translated video games, which is important work. And then now he works with our friends at Arc Systems as a game designer, programmer, and sound engineer. So he has gotten just more and more prolific, and he's started to learn a lot more, you know, as he's gone through his career. And good on him, because you got to leave the sinking ship that was Kemco at the time.
Yeah, it was kind of rough. Mm-hmm. But I guess it was kind of rough all along. So after Doughboy, you get to 1986. Mm-hmm. And I think the big game for Kemco that year was Spy versus Spy, oof, which was another computer port.
Yes.
And I remember that getting a lot of coverage in Nintendo Power, but it just didn't look that appealing to me. And it kind of has the same thing going on as Sunsoft's Xenophobe, but I don't think it's as good.
I don't think so either. And like in that game, it was just very confusing. It wasn't intuitive at all. You were searching desk drawers for different types of like weapons to use against the other spy.
Right. So it was based on the Mad Magazine cartoon by Sergio Aragonés, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And
nice. I just looked that up the other day. Yeah.
Okay. It's been a long time since I read Mad, but I do remember the people who made the good cartoons. And that was, I think Spy versus Spy was always no dialogue. It was just like pantomime cartoons of a black spy and a white spy.
Very classic.
Neither one was the good guy. Neither one was the bad guy. They were both just spies. And, you know, neither one was guaranteed to win. You never knew which spy was going to come ahead, which was actually kind of more interesting than having like a good guy, bad guy.
Agreed.
Arrangement, because you never knew like the outcome would be unpredictable. Something
and you would
happen.
Have someone to root for, which is something that I think was genius about it. Like, are you black spy or are you a white spy guy? Oh, white spy. No way, man. Black spy all the way. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you got down to the end of it, you would feel better if your spy won.
Right. And so, the two spies, the black and white spies, were always outdoing each other with like devious traps and, you know, just performing espionage feats and trying to get away with secret documents and so forth. It was very Cold War, very like sort of post James Bond. And so this game tried to convert that into a simultaneous two-player action game with a split screen where you can see what's happening on the other person's screen, and you can see if they're like laying down traps, but you know, you have to kind of keep that in mind while you're also setting up diabolical traps for the other player. So it's kind of a multitasking game, and it's kind of clever. But yeah, I don't think it really played that well on NES.
Right. Yeah. You would have to have someone who's been stuck with the game for a while, as you know, a lot of us were. You had a rental, or, you know, maybe your parents bought this, pile for you. And you just learned how to play it. it would take two people that were in those unfortunate circumstances together to actually have a good spy versus spy game. Mm-hmm. Someone who really understands the mechanics, or two people. So. Right.
So also in 86, they produced another computer port, Electrician, for the disk system, mm-hmm. which I don't really know that much about that game.
I don't either.
just watching videos of it, it was like, okay, it was a game that existed. And they also developed, I think, their first two original games, which were Space Hunter and Time Stranger, or Time Etranger. Oh. I think those are the same thing. I've definitely seen something called, in like Japanese stores, something called, you know, Time Etranger, which is just French for stranger.
Okay, sure.
But I don't know that much about them. They also are games that I like. I see these games and I look at the packages and the photos on the back of the box and think, no, I can't see spending $35 for this. So they've passed me by.
And good, good. I'm sure you're much better off for it.
So we move on to 1987, where they, I think, they took a different approach. Instead of just licensing an existing Western game, they licensed a Western property,
yes,
and brought it to Famicom. And this game actually made it over to the U.S. On NES.
Oh, man.
And that is, oh, I know you love it. It's, yeah, the first Superman game for NES.
Oh, my God.
I guess it was the only Superman game for NES.
Jeremy, okay, so I spent some time. I actually popped it in. And I'd never played this before, and
I mean, Superman talks to a really super cute version of the Statue of Liberty. What's not to like?
Oh, it
about
is.
That?
Yeah, it's chibi and it's nice and like, oh man, the Statue of Liberty is adorable, and you know, Superman looks pretty adorable too. The style, the graphics are a-okay. Let me say that right off the bat. Also, like, they're trying a lot of new ideas in this game, which I think is also very good.
Yeah, 87 was definitely a year of innovation and creativity on the Famicom, where developers were really saying, like, RPGs are what's in. We've got to put RPG components and elements into all of our games. We've got to add depth. We can't just have action games. It's got to be something more.
And this game does give you more. You have six different superpowers that you can access, and power-ups from each come from beating up different thugs in the city, and they leak out power-ups. But let me tell you, there are D power-ups, I call them, that pop out of enemies. They take your energy away. Man, is that – I hate that.
Okay,
hate
so this
that.
Sounds like Athena in a way almost, where like, things come out of enemies and you're like, I didn't want that.
Yes, yes. Kingsfield was another one that did that. And hell no. Okay, so
Kingsfield
like,
didn't come to the
mess.
U.S., did it?
Kingsfield.
Chesterfield?
No, it was by Square.
King's Knight.
King's Knight, I'm sorry.
No,
yeah.
I was thinking Chesterfield by Victor Kai.
We both got screwed up there, but yeah, King's Knight did that as well.
Yeah, I hate that design philosophy.
I do too.
It's, especially Superman. Like, that's the thing.
Unless
like,
it's
how,
kryptonite.
How do you make a game out of Superman, a guy who can do everything? Like, unless you cripple him somehow and debilitate him, you can't make an interesting and challenging game. And that's the whole point of Superman, is that he can do anything. And the question is, like, how is he living the best life and being the best example he can be? And that doesn't come through in video games. And so you get stuff like this.
Right.
So tell us about what's wrong with Superman,
okay,
by Kim Koseka.
First of all, I have one more good thing to say about it. The map on this is a very extensive map. You can ride subways to one place or another, and you can also go up in the air and fly to different places, but not all places. So it limits you there for some reason. But okay, so when you jump like 7 to 8 times the size of your pixelated caricature.
So you mentioned Mighty Bomb Jack in here.
Yes. It is basically all of the physics of Mighty Bomb Jack without the precise control of Mighty Bomb Jack. And it's,
ooh, oh
it's
dear.
Awful. It is just awful. The collision detection is terrible. You can punch enemies from like 3 feet away, which is fine, but they're also going to just shoot bullets that are the size of characters at you, which is also crazy.
And of course, Superman is very vulnerable to bullets, as we all know. Wait, what?
Right, exactly. So you can go
remember
into
the movie when someone shot him in the eye and there was like a slow-mo of the bullet, like, crumpling against his eyeball. That's Superman. This is not Superman.
This is not Superman. And even when, you know, you're Clark Kent, you have these terrible controls. Now, what happens between Clark Kent and when you turn into Superman by going into a phone booth? Well, not much. You get to jump like one or two characters higher, and your punches do moderately more damage.
I mean, Clark Kent is Superman. Clark Kent is just a disguise for Superman. So it's fine, like, I guess, but yeah, I don't know.
So the NPCs, they're awful. They tell you stuff like, I don't know how to speak English, or what are you doing here? And I know nothing. It gives you no exposition, no help at all. I hate it. I hate almost everything about this game. It really frustrated me when I put it in. I played it. I gave it a good chance. I gave it like 30 minutes. I just couldn't do it, Jeremy.
I hear you. There's just, Superman's not a good character to turn into a video game. He's just, you know, it unless you did some sort of like, you know, I could see like some sort of Animal Crossing-ish kind of game where instead of being about performing amazing feats of, you know, like combat and stuff, it's more about like, how do I manage Metropolis and, you know, like keep everyone safe and, you know, balance my time as a reporter with saving the world.
You're onto something there.
I just came up with
a
great idea, and someone needs to pay me money to make this game.
Nintendo?
Well, probably Warner.
Warner?
But Warner's kind of on the Mortal Kombat kick, so they'd have to find some way to make it, like, angry, bloody
Animal
Crossing.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine a Mortal Kombat Animal Crossing hybrid?
It depends on which way you go. Are you going to turn Mortal Kombat characters cute and friendly, or are you going to turn Animal Crossing violent? Because that's, like, the most common kind of Animal Crossing satire. So, I don't know.
Oh, man. I don't know. I don't know which way to go because either one is gold to me.
All right. Well, there you go.
Oh, man.
Anyway, this is not that Superman game. It's bad.
Avoid it at all costs, everyone.
But starting in 1988.
All right, now we're getting
what you have
stuff.
Is Kemco licensing the Mac Venture series from ICOM Simulations, an American company or Canadian or something that made four, I think, graphical adventure games for Macintosh: Deja Vu, Uninvited, Deja Vu 2, Lost in Las Vegas, or Leaving Las Vegas, or Let's Go Las Vegas, I don't know. And finally, Shadowgate. And I think Shadowgate is the most beloved and popular of these games.
I agree.
It actually, I don't know if it was the first one released in the US. It wasn't the first one they converted, but it's definitely the one that made the biggest impression. So why don't we just lump all these together? Because they all came out around the same time.
Right.
And they all were very much of a piece.
They were. They had the same graphical implementation. Mm-hmm. The point-and-click interface that Kemco put in was actually very good. It's a lot like Maniac Mansion.
Yeah, well, you know, this came before Maniac Mansion, and or at least on NES, and was actually very pioneering. I mean, you can look at this and say, like, oh, well, they pulled a lot of the concepts here from, you know...
the Scum Engine.
Well, no, I was going to say it was before Scum.
Oh, right.
From the... Yuji Horii's Portopia. Portopia,
oh, yeah, okay.
Rinjoku Satujin. I can't remember the exact
name. Yeah.
But yeah, like that was the first game that really said, how can we take a PC adventure and make it work on a console? And this took notes from that. But the graphic works, what was his name? Inoue?
Hiro.
No, Sueda, that's it.
Oh, Sueda,
I don't know
yes.
where I was getting Inoue from. Sueda, he tried to make the graphical interface visually appropriate to the games in question. So in Shadowgate, it's like everything is taking place, like, you know, there's like a pen writing out the text on a scroll.
Yes.
And in Deja Vu, you play as a detective. And so it's like you've got a little notebook with like lined paper.
Yeah, and the typewriter goes across. Yeah. And in Uninvited, there's a spider.
Right. So he really put some thought into, you know, making this look good and, you know, giving it some personality. And I think that went a long way towards selling the game. You know, it is these were all graphical adventures. So the bottom, I would say the bottom third of the screen was basically given over to, you know, text.
Action commands. Yeah. Yep.
And so then I think I want to say the left side was menus. And there was like, you know, menus that kind of had layers to them.
Oh, it was the right side.
The right side. Okay. And then yeah, the right side was the window into the view.
That's right.
The room.
Basically, your inventory would take up the upper right-hand side. And the bottom third would be how you interacted with both the graphical pane and the inventory that you had on the upper right.
Right. So these games, you know, they are 80s graphical adventures, so they can be unfair. They can be arbitrary. They have moments where you're like, this sucks. But
very unfair deaths a lot of the times.
But that actually is part of the charm with Shadowgate, because it's not super punitive. You can save any time. So, mm-hmm. you know, like, before I do something, I should just save the game. So, you know, you pick up a sword. Oh, and a kraken comes out of the water and eats you, and death shows up. Well, sure. That's fine. It's okay.
Also, another thing that makes it okay is in the ports anyway for NES, if you died, you just want a screen back.
Mm-hmm.
So saving wasn't actually – you didn't need to like scum save through it as a lot of people. So like you would just go one screen back. It's not that much of a penalty. And another thing about dying is this game had a sardonic tone. It was always very – sarcastic, and the ways that you would die are humorous. The flavor text is really amusing. So
yeah, this game has a really Shadowgate especially has a kind of strange reputation in Japan. It's not quite Kusoge, but it definitely like it's kind of seen, I think, with a mixed of affection and bemusement, because they rewrote the text to be more first person in perspective, and it's very, very lurid and exaggerated.
Okay. Right.
So it has this kind of like reputation as this sort of goofy game. they like played up a lot of the elements way more than they are in the American version.
I did not know that.
So yeah, it has kind of this like oddball place in the Japanese Famicom pantheon. But yeah, the flavor text in this game, all three of the games really, like, It's really sharp and clear and funny, and you know, there's a lot of snark to it. Like, well, you really blew that one, didn't you?
Yes. Kind
of
thing.
And that really works in its favor, because especially at the time, there were not that many games on NES with even competent writing. So to get not just competent but like funny and good writing, that made a huge difference. Like that, there's a lot of appeal to that. So that really made these games stand out.
Absolutely. With all these games coming out with, I mean, just blatant misspellings and grammar errors, this was a real nice breath of fresh air here. Now, the ports here also added a hint system, which was not in the Mac Venture series, by hitting the select button, but rarely would it actually help you. It would give you very, very vague hints or just give you nothing almost. It would just be like more flavor text, which is fine. But it was a convoluted game. I mean, I'm telling you, like, a lot of the solutions in this game are not telegraphed at all. Mm. You're just kind of blindly reaching out using items here and there, unless you really pay attention.
Yeah, but that's a function of the original games. That is the, you know, how they were designed.
Truth.
That is not Kemco being like, we don't know how to make games. it was really like, this is how ICOM designed games. And, you know, at the time, this was, again, before Scum. This was before Maniac Mansion.
Right.
And so the idea of a fair and balanced and friendly and approachable adventure game, that just didn't really exist. So these games, I think, were kind of ahead of the curve in that sense, because yeah, they would kill you instantly, and they had some cheap deaths, lots of cheap deaths, and you know, things could be confusing, but I think on the whole they were much clearer than you would see in like a Sierra game. And I know people get upset when we talk about Sierra games because we don't have much nice to say about them, but you know, like, they kind of set the tone for adventure games in the 80s, where it was just like, ah, screw you. Oh, you didn't do one little random thing that you didn't know about and wasn't obvious at the, like, in the first 5 minutes of the game? Well, you can't actually finish this game now. Sorry about the last 20 hours.
You're screwed.
Yeah, Shadowgate didn't do that. Like, I think the worst thing that could happen was you farted around too long and you would run out of torches. But I think even then there's a way to work around that, isn't there?
No, there isn't. There's only a set amount of torches in the game. So that does give you a definitive time limit, which I think is a really neat aspect to it.
But it's extremely generous.
It is.
I mean, I remember beating this game in a weekend at the time without, you know, without like a guide or anything. This was back in before Game Pass.
Wow, you phenom.
What's that?
I said, wow, you phenom. No, calls to Nintendo Power?
No, but this was the only one I did that for. Like, Uninvited and Deja Vu, I never finished.
Yeah.
But Shadowgate, for some reason, I don't know, Shadowgate especially, but all three of these games really showed off one of Kemco's strengths in the NES era, which was great box art.
Oh, like
The original Shadowgate is especially dynamic. It's got a gargoyle that is like transform. It's in the process of transforming from stone to flesh, and it's printed. It's like a you know, painted, airbrushed at this very dynamic angle that's kind of breaking out of the frame of the box and like kind of interacting in a destructive way with the trade dress of the box. It really stands out. It's got like some neon colors to it, like neon green and a very vivid red. It just really stands out, like against white and black. Yeah.
It's
really great graphic design. And that carried through to a lot of their games.
Well, Deja Vu, it captures all the noir that the music's there. But that box art, man, I'm telling you.
It's got like a detective like standing against a brick wall looking kind of over his shoulder at the distance, right?
Oh, man. It draws like... like, wow, it sparks the mind in the imagination. Like, and it's exactly what you do in the game. So, like, whoever they did to commission, if that was internal or they maybe went out to a different artist, they nailed it. Absolutely. Agreed.
Yeah. I would say the Mac Venture games on NES are very strong, and I think maybe kind of give Kemco a better reputation among the NES literati than they necessarily deserve.
I agree.
But you have to hand it to them for recognizing these are good adventure games, and they did a great job of porting them. So is that really so bad? Like, I think they do deserve the plaudits.
Absolutely, they
just were kind of fumbled a lot when they actually made their own games. For example, Ghost Lion, an extraordinarily generic RPG on NES. It was just
remarkable box art.
Yes. Oh, my God. I love the box art. It's like, I'm going to go do aerobics and save the world.
Oh, by the way, here's a lion.
Oh, right. There's like... yeah, it's I don't even know how to.
It's just remarkable. Look it up in Google image search.
It's an RPG with a female hero, a heroine, a woman in the lead, and that's unusual for the time.
It is.
But for whatever reason, instead of saying like she should be in cool armor, they were like she should be wearing, you know, like an aerobics outfit, like, you know, leg warmers and the off the shoulder t-shirt and everything.
The headband, yeah.
Yeah, and like super frosted, permed out, blonde
curly
hair.
Sure.
And a white lion. It's like, I'm pretty sure she's Siegfried and Roy's assistant. I think, when they were researching the Las Vegas part of the Uninvited or Deja Vu 2 that never released, they were just like, let's go to Vegas and let's go see Siegfried and Roy. Oh, that chick, she should be on our cover.
Yeah, grab her. Actually, let's paint her. Let's paint her right now.
Yep. So, yeah, that not a great game, but definitely one of the best covers of the NES era?
I would put it up there. Most memorable.
Yeah, sure.
There we go. There it is.
There's also in 88, There's also, or 89 maybe, Rescue the Embassy Mission.
Okay.
Which is famous for being a game you can finish in 5 minutes.
Yeah. Okay, so I played this too.
Okay, let's hear about it.
All right, so this was developed by Infogrames initially in 88 for PCs in France, actually. The original title was Hostages, which makes sense. Kemco kind of snapped it up right away, gave it the Nintendo bath, which includes censoring the nationality and the politics.
Kemco had a relationship with Infogrames of some sort, and I don't know what it is, but we'll talk about more another of their Infogrames games later. But yes, this, I guess maybe this is the beginning of a strange and somewhat not beautiful relationship.
Agreed. So basically, initially you got ground floor soldier positioning. You have to dodge spotlights. That's part one of the game. There's three phases to it. And then this part two is the search and destroy, which basically you are a sniper on top of a building and you are looking through 9 different windows through a sniper scope. And when a shadowy figure goes appears in a window pane, you must shoot. And that way you clear out a lot of the terrorists that are attacking the embassy. And then you get a little bit of a cutscene where you see a helicopter drop off some more operatives on top of the building. And the third part is basically scaling the wall on the outside, and you get to bust in through a window. And then the last part of it is kind of like a first person, like, do you remember Zybots? Atari
yes,
games.
Yes.
Okay, so it's a lot like that, but on the 8-bit NES. And yeah, you kind of just turn around, and if you see an enemy, like, you have a map, and you just shoot them and you spray them.
I mean, that was in a few games at the time. That was in the first Golgo 13 Top Secret episode.
Okay, yeah.
And Platoon.
Oh, Platoon. Yeah. Yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Holy moly, that's another crappy game.
Really weird scene where you're, or sequence where you're mowing down tunnel rats. It's weird. Or not, yes. Not tunnel rats, but like the tunnel dwellers as
right.
a tunnel rat. Yeah, I don't know.
So, no, I totally forgot about that. But that's the game, folks. Thanks for playing. Thanks for spending $59.99 or $49.99. Hope you had a great time. But yeah, once you got good at it, basically all you could do is up the difficulty and thanks for playing. And so, I don't know. That's I would have been really steamed if I spent my hard earned money on that.
Yeah, I could see that not going over well.
So that's that.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't have much else to say about it.
Right. So that was maybe not the best pickup they could have gotten from a license choice.
Oh, hey, you know, one other thing I wanted to say is that it uses squad based combat way before like Tom Clancy or Rainbow Six or anything like that. I will give it that. I mean, it's actually a beautiful looking game for the NES too. So there are good points to it. It's just
it does
over
have great graphics,
quick.
Right? Yeah,
yeah, that's all.
Yeah, there's just nothing there. It's like extremely slight. It would be like, you know, a QTE or two in a modern game,
right? Yeah,
but there it's missing the other 40 hours of gameplay.
True that.
So another game that Kimco picked up from another license they picked up from the West around this time was Bugs Bunny, and lots of other licenses, really, because they gave us the Crazy Castle, Bugs Bunny Crazy Castle. But that game was many things. It started out actually in Japan on Disk System as a Roger Rabbit game, just called Roger Rabbit. And that's different than LJN's Roger Rabbit, developed by Rare, which was kind of like an adventure weird sort of game.
Oof.
In the Ghostbusters vein. This was just a puzzle platformer where originally Roger Rabbit was running around trying to avoid the weasels. That's why all the enemies kind of on NES have like this, the green and white and I think red color schemes, even though it doesn't make sense for Sylvester to be green. And they all behave the same. It's because they're all just weasels. Well, they don't all behave the same, but they don't really necessarily behave like you would expect. But when they brought that to Game Boy, they called it Mickey Mouse in Japan. And they just like switched over the graphics to be Mickey Mouse characters. And when they brought it to NES and Game Boy in America, they called it Bugs Bunny Crazy Castle. And they switched the graphics same gameplay, just to be, you know, Bugs, Sylvester, Yosemite Sam. I can't remember who else. But yeah, it's like all these characters trying to kill Daffy Duck, even trying to kill Bugs Bunny for some reason. And it's not a terrible game. I think there was an Angry Video Game Nerd episode that exaggerated how bad it is, as always.
Oh yeah.
But as an actual game,
I remember
game,
what happened in that episode.
I haven't seen it. So what did happen?
Oh, well, well, he beats the living crap out of Bugs Bunny and then ends up defecating all over him. So,
okay. You
know, in classic.
That explains
nerd.
A lot of the comments I got on my Crazy Castle video. All right. Good to know.
Sure.
It is not that bad. It's a perfectly serviceable little game. And apparently it did really well for Kemco because this became one of their mainstay series.
Yes.
I think it got like 4 or 5 sequels. And
dear God, was it that
they
many?
Just they hoard that series out. It's the license attached to Crazy Castle include Roger Rabbit, Mickey Mouse, Bugs Bunny, Woody Woodpecker, Hugo, which is like a French cartoon series, Garfield, and Kid Clown. Wow, I don't remember Kid Clown. Well, no, that's because that's Kimco's original character, Do Not Steal. They, I guess, eventually said, what if we just did one of these games with our own character now that Crazy Castle is a brand? And so they did, and I don't know. Crazy Castle, or Kid Clown, is mostly notable for starring in a game called Kid Clown in Nightmare World. It's not Nightmare, it's like the mayor of the night. Like the elected official who officiates, you know, the evening hours. I don't know. They did some weird stuff.
That is odd. I didn't catch that.
That wasn't a Crazy Castle game. That was like an isometric or, you know, oblique 3D perspective platformer. Kind of like Landstalker, but as a linear platformer.
And that's weird.
Yeah.
That's really odd. I didn't get a chance to play that one. So, but the way you're describing it, how would that even work?
Not great.
Yeah.
One game that I think does work really well and that deserves some credit and is original, more or less, for Kemco is The Sword of Hope, their very first Game Boy game. That came out really early in the Game Boy's life. And, I mean, it's very clearly them saying, well, you know, we had a lot of success with these MacVenture games, and kids love this, and we've got this engine here that we developed for, like, the adventure scenes. But what if we made something that kids in Japan would like more? What do kids in Japan like more? Oh, they like RPGs. So it's a hybrid adventure game RPG, and it works really well. I really like it. It's a very good game. I need to play all the way through it someday. But, you know, what I have played, you know, probably spent 5 hours with it. It's very entertaining and fun, and is a really fresh take on two genres.
I remember going to high school and I had, you know, a subscription to Nintendo Power at the time, and I had already played through Kemco's, you know, Shadowgate, Deja Vu. And when I saw that The Sword of Hope was from Kemco and they gave it a really high rating, and I just saw the screenshots, I was ecstatic. I was like, I'm picking this up day one. And I did. And I had a great time with Sword of Hope. I thought it was very well done.
Yeah.
The meshing.
Yeah, I recommend anyone who has the opportunity to track that down, do it. I think Sword of Hope 2 is available on 3DS Virtual Console, and I think that's pretty much the same game. It's a much rarer or more expensive game. So, like, you can pick up Sword of Hope pretty cheaply. I think Sword of Hope 2 is pricey. So grab that $3 Virtual Console game and give it a try, because they're pretty much the same thing, I believe.
So we're kind of almost out of the NES era here with Kemco.
Yep, they released a game called North and South, and I didn't look up this game in advance, but I believe that is also a port of a strategy game from another publisher, another developer. And it's one of those games that you're like, oh, Koei didn't make that? Okay, that's weird.
Yeah, it seems like it would have Koei written all over it, mm-hmm.
But I guess Koei was like, no, we just want to study, focus on Japanese and European history. Thank you. We don't care about your American history.
This is like a stripped down, a very stripped down, like Nobunaga's ambition mm-hmm. type of thing with you get your troops and you converge on certain cities, according to the Civil War, of course. And it's decent for what it is. but it did not hold my attention very much. I played it for about 15 minutes.
Yeah. I wonder if they could release a Civil War-based game these days. It's such a hot-button topic.
Yeah, like, I don't know.
Kind of hard to sympathize with the Confederates, honestly.
Right. I agree with that 100%.
So also in 1990, another licensed game, this one starring Snoopy, Snoopy's Magic Show, which is bad.
It's a with a question mark.
I mean, maybe it's not bad and I just don't like it, but I didn't enjoy playing it for Game Boy Works. It's right. You play as Snoopy for some reason. There's nothing about the game that is especially Snoopy-ish. And the magic show is that there's a ball that bounces around and you're trying to like find all the Woodstocks in a level before the ball hits you, and the ball will kill you because Snoopy is not good at magic, I guess.
No.
So he's like, I don't know, summoned some sort of demon that has possessed the soul of this ball and wants to destroy him. I really don't know.
I believe that Woodstock has special powers that could protect Snoopy.
Oh, yeah?
That's why he's hunting for him.
I see. Well, no, you find all the Woodstocks and you just move on to the next level.
Oh.
Well, there's like 5 Woodstocks on the stage.
Yes. Well, that's the help.
He just needs a secretary and then he can go on.
That's right.
Yeah, anyway, not a great game, but you seem to have a lot of thoughts on Snoopy's Silly Sports Spectacular for NES. So well, let's hear about that.
Okay, so I don't really have many thoughts on it. Although originally this was developed by Gremlin Graphics as Alternative World Games. Now, this is not a direct port over. Kemco did some work to this, and this originally appeared on the Commodore 64, the Amstrad CPC, and ZX Spectrum.
Promising.
Promising, right. Okay, so what had happened in Japan, this was originally called Donald Duck. Now, this harkens back.
Oh, God, again?
Yeah, this harkens back to the Bugs Bunny crazy castle thing. So Kemco had the Kemco had the rights to release the Disney-based video games in Japan, so they chose Donald Duck. Now, for North America, Kemco decided to license Snoopy for the North American version because they did not have that. Capcom had those rights. So they went to Snoopy instead. And so we get this amazing game that features 6 mini games. I'm not going to go too much into detail about this, Jeremy. Just, it's a 2-player game, and that is its biggest strength. Let me just say that.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, to me, the marketing or the licensing is more interesting than the game.
Right.
But anytime someone puts in the word sports in a game title, I'm like, I don't care.
It's basically Onyx's Winter Games. Mm-hmm. But
Epics.
I'm sorry. Yeah, Epics. And yeah, but stripped down and
not as good.
Not as good at all.
Too bad, because Winter Games hasn't really aged that well either.
No, it hasn't.
But yeah, the weird licensing stuff, I'm sure, has to do with regionality. Like, you know, Capcom had the Donald Duck license.
Right.
DuckTales and everything, all the Disney stuff wrapped up on NES. So Kemco was like, well, we'll just shove a different sprite in there. And good to go.
You know what? They were good at
it. And I mean, like, Snoopy's Magic Show, that did not need to be a Snoopy game. There is nothing... nothing whatsoever that is Snoopy about that game. There's no great pumpkin. You are not flying a Sopwith camel. It's just you're a character who happens to look like Snoopy. And that's kind of the approach they took with all their licensed games.
And it's brilliant. And that's what made Kemco put food on the table. And that's what, you know, that's where they made a lot of money.
Yep.
A lot of parents would come in and be like, well, let's get that Snoopy game for young Jonathan.
Yep. He loves him some generic license games. Yes, indeed.
Say
I think we need to kind of wrap up here, but
right,
I do want to talk about 1991's Draken, which yes. is another Infogrames game and another PC port, and you know, this was very much kind of Kemco's bread and butter, but it's such a weird game. It's notable, you know, the Super NES was a role-playing game powerhouse. And Draken is notable for being the first RPG to launch on Super NES in America. Cool. But it's a port of a PC game, and it's hard to wrap your head around. It's a really abstract sort of game.
Open world, so
yeah, I mean of. It's a kind small of one, but it's like super ambitious. So the world is open. It's divided into four quadrants. There's like north, east, west, south, something like that. And so you, as a party of people that you put together from generic characters, travel around and are trying to beat like a dragon race. But some dragon races people are friendly and some are not. And sometimes you're walking along and all of a sudden a giant cat head pops out of the ground and uses lasers and kills you instantly.
That thing was scary. I was legitimately scared of that when I first played it.
And it's interesting because it uses like this first-person 3D perspective when you're exploring the overworld, but it's not using Nintendo, the Super NES Mode 7. It's like a primitive polygon system.
Yeah, I was going to say, those are like polygons.
Yeah, it's like there was a lot happening with this game, and I feel like there's something really interesting there, but it just doesn't come together on Super NES. There was a sequel that they published 4 years later called Dragon View, which is now very expensive because it's good and late. And of course it's expensive because it's Super NES. But that was like, they really worked that one out a lot better. It has a great reputation and it's supposedly a much better take on the same Draken concept. But yeah, this is a challenging game.
It really sure is. I think the most frustrating thing about it is you don't really have direct control over your fighters when you're fighting. It's very much a
you don't even
dice
have,
roll.
You don't even have indirect control with the menu. It's not like Final Fantasy. It's like a real-time combat system where your characters just automatically will wander into whatever direction they feel like wandering and attack whatever they feel like attacking.
Very frustrating.
And you can kind of issue commands, but it's very sort of hands-off. It's a little bit like, you know, what they tried to do with Ogre Battle, except instead of being turn-based, it's all just happening on the fly. And, like, you can cast a spell on your characters to make them invisible. So I recorded a lot of footage of this game that is just, like, invisible sparkles, like, floating around, getting into battles, and apparently dying. I don't know. Like, oh, yeah, and sometimes, like, stars will fall out of the sky and turn into, like, some sort of star monster thing.
I remember that. Whoa. That is a memory. Holy moly. I hadn't remembered that in a long time.
It's just a game that does nothing to explain itself. And I feel like, you know, if that had been, like, the only game I owned for my Super NES, I would have cracked the code. I would have unraveled it.
Absolutely.
And figured it out. But I did not. I rented it and said, what? And because I didn't...
Along with everyone else.
I was not $60 in the hole for it. I had no obligation to continue playing. And so I didn't revisit it until I, you know, did a retrospective for Super NES Works. And it makes a little more sense to me as a man who has played many, many RPGs now. But it's still very, very abstract. It's... they were doing a lot here, or trying to do a lot, and I don't know how effectively they managed to pull that off. But
not very
God bless them for trying.
And God bless them for Dragon View later on.
All right, the last game that we have really kind of written up in detail is Phalanx, and it looks like you don't have details written about the game itself.
No.
But about the cover art.
Right.
And let's face it, Phalanx is a very middle-of-the-road horizontal shooter for Super NES, and that is not a system that is known for being great for shooters. So the thing that does make this stand out is the extremely weird cover art, which is, it's an old man with a banjo, like dressed like a hillbilly, sitting on his porch, looking shocked as space fighters fly overhead shooting at each other.
Right. And
it's
so
a weird choice.
Basically, what the advertising company that Kemco had hired had said, they were interviewed by Destructoid, and they basically said for different products, they would put different teams or different ideas on them. Well, for this one, they went for the quote-unquote heavy huh factor, and they achieved it pretty dang good. A lot of people know about this cover because it is so It does have the heavy huh factor.
I never played the game, but every time I saw it on the rental shop shelves back in the day, I would be like, what the hell?
They got it out of everybody. And that's why it's so memorable. Yeah, the game itself is a very middle-of-the-road shooter. There's not much. I mean, it's solid. I'll give it that. Colorful and decent. You know, there's nothing very much wrong with it. It's just not it's not one of the upper echelon shooters that you hear people talk about. And you always hear about the cover art. So it's interesting that they actually tracked down the people who designed it and, you know, gave him an interview. And this mm-hmm. is pretty cool. Kind of explaining the backstory of it.
Yeah, I agree. But not necessarily a great game.
Right.
God bless him for putting a weird cover on it, though. All right. Just to kind of wrap up here. I mean, this is kind of Kimco in a nutshell. It's like, oh, yeah, this I remember this. It wasn't that great, but I remember this. I mean, that's the company. I will say that arguably the worst thing they ever published was published in 1995. On Virtual Boy, and you say, oh, ha, 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 Virtual Boy, that sucks. Of course it was bad. No, Virtual Boy was a troubled console system, but it wasn't inherently bad. Like, the games on it were often quite good. However, Kemco is notable for having published the worst game to see release for Virtual Boy in America, and that's Virtual League Baseball, and it is just an absolute pile of crap. Like, I was able to find something, you know, I'm through the American Library of the Virtual Boy now for Virtual Boy Works. I was able to find something redeeming about every game except this one. And it is a bad, bad game by any standard. It's a bad baseball game by 1995 standards. Like, the fact that, I don't know, this game would have been kind of like, 1983 for it to come out in 1995 and be this awful.
It's embarrassing.
Yeah, I mean,
and also that so advertising.
Oh, well, even irrespective of the advertising, just the fact that they could release such a bad baseball game in 95 and it does nothing to take advantage of the Virtual Boy's capabilities. Like, they could have done some sort of scaling effect or some sort of, you know, immersive in the field effect, but they didn't. They didn't. It's really bad. It's so terrible. And then they advertised it with hot, like chili farts.
Yeah, the ass crack of yes. of someone watching a baseball game
talking about chili farts. I mean, chili dog farts.
It played right into the Play It Loud type of marketing that Nintendo had going on at the time. But God, it was just how many wrong moves can you make with one game?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say that one game just doomed Virtual Boy on its own. The system could have been a contender, but but then that came out.
Oh, dear
God. I don't know. That was bad. But finally, Swan Song, Kemco. Well, not a Swan Song, but just to wrap this, because we talked about what they do now, but maybe the most interesting choice in their later life was the N64 and Game Boy Color conversions of Daikatana. They were not good at picking horses in the 90s. Virtual League Baseball for Virtual Boy, and then Daikatana, the infamous game that was supposed to be like the future of shooters and was a giant mess and made John Romero look like an idiot.
Yeah, didn't he make bitch?
Not really, yeah. Well, this was the marketing team's decision. And apparently John Romero was like, I'm not comfortable with this. But they said, no, it's great, trust us. And everyone said, no. So, yeah, lots of bad moves made all around.
Yeah, they started to stumble there pretty hard.
But, you know, that's Kemco right there. Woo-hoo! That's the Kemco experience. Like, oh, that's interesting and bad. So,
yeah.
Yeah, some of these podcasts you go in and you're like, oh, I have lots of good things to say. And some of them you go in and you're like, this probably isn't going to go anywhere good. And it doesn't.
Like I said before, to sum up everything, I was excited about this. I said, yeah, all right, I bet you Kemco Sega has a bunch of awesome games because I remember Deja Vu and I remember Shadowgate. And I get down into it and, wow, they were a below-average developer with a very smart, savvy publishing know-how. And that's how I would just sum them up.
Yep, pretty much. So they had some successes and they had a lot of failures. And they're still around making extraordinarily generic RPGs. So if you are in the mood for an extraordinarily generic RPG, And you know where to look. Just hunt for Seiko, Kimco on Nintendo Switch, and they will lull you to sleep.
Go to town.
But yeah, I don't, in any case, I would definitely recommend checking out the new remake of Shadowgate for Switch and Xbox One and PS4. It doesn't have the same kind of like unique style of art and the same sort of personality, but it still kind of hits all the points. It's a pretty faithful remake of Shadowgate with some modern niceties, like a talking skull Yorick who will offer you hints if you want. And it's more on point than the hitting select on the NES version. So that's kind of cool.
It's very beautiful.
That legacy still kind of lives on. I guess that's not technically a Kemco game, but like they're the ones who brought it to everyone. They're the reason people love Shadowgate.
True.
So you have to give them the credit for that. But I think that's really all the energy I can give to Kemco.
Here
so
too. I'm exhausted, buddy.
Why don't we wrap this up? So Anthony, tell us a little bit about yourself and where we can find you on the big world wide web.
Okay. Well, I do a podcast called Game and Movie Podcast. I've taken a break from it. I need to go and sow my oats other places. But I do have a punk rock and roll band. We're called Holy Shit, and we're doing a Japan and Vietnam tour.
Okay.
And we're leaving on Thursday. So everyone wish me good luck. I suppose by the time you hear this, I'll be back already with lots of cool Japanese food in my stomach.
Or else you'll be hiding in the embassy. One of the two.
One of the two. That's right. But yeah, that's a little bit about me. If you want to check out Game and Movie Podcast, you can check out old episodes on YouTube. And I don't know, maybe you can throw me a message on Twitter under Game and Movie Podcast as well. Or I think it's Game and Movie Podcast USA. Thank you, Jeremy, for letting me appear on Retronauts again.
Yeah, actually, absolutely. Awesome. Thanks for joining. And yeah, it's good to have you on the show. Of course, Retronauts, you can find at Retronauts.com, on iTunes, on various other platforms such as Libsyn. We go live every Monday and every other Wednesday or Friday, and that's something you can listen to for free. But if you would like those episodes early and with higher audio quality for all those cool game music interludes, I would recommend going to Patreon.com/Retronauts, where for $3 a month, which is less than the cost of a coffee at most, coffee shop chains, you can get yourself a 1 week early access to every episode of Retronauts. And for higher values, you can even get cool bonuses and stuff. So that's maybe something worth doing. I don't know. It would be great to have your support, but even if you don't support us, we're still grateful for you taking your time to listen to our podcast. And we will be back in however many days. I don't know what episode this is going to be. But we'll be back soon with another episode, so look forward to that. And look forward to probably another episode with Anthony next year at Midwest Gaming Classic. And in the meantime, don't go play those Kemco RPGs.
Please don't.